Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I'm the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
Hello there, folks. Welcome to your Bank Holiday Monday Second Captain's Football Podcast. I'm going to guess you enjoyed that weekend a little more if you're a Liverpool fan than a Manchester United supporter. Certainly the mood of the managers of these two great clubs could not have been more different post-match. Jurgen Klopp getting all philosophical after beating Cardiff. Said, if you're only motivated by winning the Holy Grail, then something is wrong with you. We are motivated ourselves because we play for this club, because we want to win football games, because we enjoy the ride together with our fans. That's the truth. As for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, a 4-0 defeat is rarely good for the mood. And he was asked in his press conference whether his players care enough to play for Manchester United. He puffed his cheeks out and said, I don't know.
I don't know.
It's Owen and Ken today. Hi, Ken. How are you?
Hi, Owen. How are you?
I'm all right. Ole's at the wheel, all right, but... is he driving Manchester United off a cliff? Is the question.
Oh dear. Oh my God.
Only 6 games into his full-time position. Already we're into the territory of players taking to Twitter to apologise for the team's performance. Why is it goalkeepers? Goalkeepers always seem to self-flagellate in a more consistent manner than outfield players. So De Gea was on Twitter. I don't know if you've seen these quotes. Difficult to put what I'm feeling today into words. As captain, I want to say that the performance of the team today, on top of the result, was not up to the standard expected when you put on this shirt. We know we have to improve, but words mean little. We have to give everything for this club. Thank you for your unconditional support, De Gea says, hopefully.
Yeah, and based on what I could see of the replies to that, it didn't go down very well.
It rarely does when you do that. I presume you don't read the replies, though, if you're David De Gea. You put it up there, it's done.
Well, it could be like Robbie Keane the other day, where his Instagram contained a message which began, I think it was... suggested copy here. You know, it was one of those where he just pasted in the whole email or text or whatever without deleting where appropriate. So it's only a matter of time before the first sincere apology tweet from a player comes out with that in it. This wasn't the day, but there, if I was to condense the gist of a lot of the replies, it was, talk is cheap. Now let's see some...
I wouldn't mind. He said talk is cheap in his second tweet. We know we have to improve, but words mean little. We have to give everything for this club. He stopped short of a full apology, it should be said. Never in that entire double tweet did he
truly
say the word.
Apologize.
I'm sorry, yeah.
So I abase myself.
Come on, De Gea. You got to abase yourself fully. This is your Bank Holiday podcast. Champions Cup rugby show will be tomorrow. That's going to be on the World Service featuring the ex-Munster man Dunica Ryan now with Racing 92. Dunica has gone down a treat when we've had him on before, so looking forward to that. To become a World Service member, you know, you have to just go to secondcaptains.com/join. Let's report on some Bank Holiday weekend sport, please, Ken.
So, Owen, you know, I mean, you mentioned the hysteria of apology that's sweeping Manchester United. Obviously, Solskjaer apologising, De Gea kind of apologising, Ashley Young apologising. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer during his press conference several times jabbed with his thumb behind himself to the wall, covered in sponsors logos just behind him, saying, "Those fans out there, that's the only way we didn't lose Severn Tay. It's the only we weren't out so." And talking about the great support that they'd had, and it certainly was loud support. I mean, as Saucer said, they didn't attack the players, but there was some barbed commentary I felt from the supporters on elements of the performance. I don't know if they quite got into the ironic cheers level, but there was a, you know, they clearly weren't happy about it. But what's amazing here, what's amazing, and not just about Manchester United, also about Everton, is the crazy fluctuations in form that these teams have both had. I mean, Everton started the season reasonably well. You know, they had lost very few games.
Well, you were singing their praises early on, weren't you?
Coming up, the Liverpool defeat, say, when they lost at Anfield, that was the start of December. That was their fourth defeat of the season. You know, they've been pretty solid and looked like a team that's come together. And, you know, players like Richarlison is a top quality player. You know, it seemed as though this is a team that's going to kind of come together. Then a completely disastrous run. You know, they win four of their next 17 matches, lost 10 of those, you know, couldn't kick snow off a rope. Now they've won four of their last five. You know, as many wins in this brief period since Paddy's Day as they had between sort of March and December. Whereas Manchester United are just the opposite. And their situation now is, it's like, defies belief.
Yeah.
Like, 6 defeats in 8. It's going to be 7 defeats in 9 if they lose to City, as you'd have to expect them to. You know, it's been pretty bad. 7 defeats in 9 matches. I actually emailed Duncan Alexander at Opta to ask, has this ever happened before?
How do you mean, has this ever happened before?
Have they ever lost that many matches in a run of 9?
Oh, Man United, yeah.
Yeah. He said, I found a run of 7-10 spring 2001. So that was, if you remember, when Laurent Blanc had come into the team and they went through this massive wobble. And wasn't it just when Ferguson was going to be retiring?
Yeah, that would ring a bell, yeah.
There was this sort of, is Fergie retiring? And then it was at Christmas that year that he said, I'm not leaving.
That's you, fucked Yorkie. Somebody turned around to Dwight York, apparently, when Ferguson announced he was staying.
That was just around there. So that was 7-10, not quite, it's about 7-9. 6-7 in April, May 1989. That was when things were really flatlining for Alex Ferguson, and, you know, it was kind of culminating. That was the period of misery that culminated in the ta-ra, Fergie, 3 years of excuses, and it's still, you know, whatever. And obviously then things turned around. 6-8 in January, March 81. So that's actually the last equivalent run. I mean, 6-7 is actually worse. 6-8 in October, November 77. 6-8 in October, December 76. They did this a bit in the 70s when things weren't good. But the first 7 defeats in 9 he could find was 1963. This would have been a Manchester United team featuring a young John Giles, mm-hmm. soon to be moved on by Matt Busby. And they, it wasn't good. October 62. But that is the last time that Manchester United have had a run of form as bad as it will be if they lose to Manchester City on Wednesday. And the next game is against Chelsea, yeah. who at that point could be in a position to seal their own place in the top four and leave Manchester United in a pretty poor way. Although already the top four situation is looking... it's looking bad. I mean, 538, I know these, you know, 538 doesn't get everything right. But they track the sort of chances of the teams in the top four actually making, obviously, Man City and Liverpool are already there. Tottenham, 89%, Chelsea, 49%, Arsenal, 54%, and Manchester United, only 7%.
Nerd nonsense, Ken.
Nerd nonsense.
I mean, can you track belief? Can you track values? Can you track attacking football? Can you track a club legend, a goal like Gunnar Solskjaer, at the wheel of your club?
Well, this is
possibly you can track some of those
because emotions are so powerful, and especially the emotions unleashed by a heady 1990s nostalgia rush of Manchester United content, amplified and empowered by their new surveillance capitalism app. they just know how to push everyone's buttons. And that's why you got pundits. You know, this is from March 6th, I think.
Ole Gunnar, I've three very quick questions for you. How long would you like on your contract? What would your salary like to be? And where would you like the statue?
That was March 6th. Was this from around the same time?
I do, yeah. But listen, all you've got to do, Man United might not thank me, but get the contract out, put it on the table, let him sign it, let him write whatever numbers he wants to put on there, give him what he's done now since he's come in, and let him sign the contract and go. Ollie's with the wheel, man. He's doing it. He's doing his thing. Man United are back.
This must have all been just post-PSG, was it?
Yeah. Now, I know this is all very, you know, funny. It all looks, yeah. I mean, this, what I'm saying is this, you can get carried away in a couple of different ways. I mean, just as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer at that time was not necessarily, you know, there was that sense of, oh, they've just stumbled across the right guy. Like, you know, who could have thought? It's like a fairy tale. You know, it's like he's sword from stone type of, there's like some mythical, he's been anointed in some way. He stands apart, right? And okay, there wasn't much of a basis for that. But equally, the fact that they've lost a lot of games recently and look really bad, does that mean that, you know, what I'm saying is, Is he not as good as he looked during the initial amazing run? Which, you've got to remember, they set records. He set a club record for away wins in a row, 9 in a row. The previous Manchester United club record for away wins was 7 in a row. So Solskjaer broke that. Best ever start by a manager at a Premier League club in terms of points over the first, whatever, 10 or 11 games. Now they're on what could be the worst run for nearly 40 years. And have 5 away defeats in a row, which is the worst run, I think, since 1981, and the worst run of without a clean sheet since 1998. So it's like everything he does is somehow a record.
Yeah.
It's like, but you know, you shouldn't necessarily get carried away both ways. The only thing I would say is that while in the run where they were winning a lot, there was, you know, the expected goals evidence, and I'm sorry to bring it up, I know it's a trigger phrase for you, but that suggests that they were doing a bit better than the...
It's not really a trigger phrase, but you just have to look at shots on target. That's usually around the same as expected goals. You see, people go to a lot of work getting the expected goals in there. We've had shots on target for a long time.
That's true. But they did have it did suggest that maybe their results were a bit better than their performances. But when you look at it now, it's like, no, the results about match the performances.
What I will say about you raise the notion there that maybe he's getting criticised too much now, but the point remains that he did get all that praise. He did get all that acclaim. Okay, yeah. He didn't come out and say, give me acclaim, but he's a Manchester United manager. And not only did he get the acclaim, he got the job based on that run. And he knows as well as anybody, I'm sure, that when you're the Manchester United manager, then you're going to have to take a lot of stick if things go amiss as they are going at the moment. There seem to be a lot of apologists saying a few weeks ago, this guy's the greatest manager ever, you know, unbelievable, and so on. And then when it starts going a bit all over the place for him, well, the players aren't up to it. Like, I didn't hear people saying that 3 or 4 or 5 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Well, I don't have a huge amount of sympathy for, and I also think, I'm not sure about Solskjaer in terms of his personality. Like, it's grand, he smiles, he takes the acclaim, you know, he wears the success lightly. I'm not sure if he's wearing the failure quite as lightly. It strikes me he's already having a go with the players very pointedly. He seems to have a pretty high opinion of his own management style. I don't know if behind the scenes he's questioning what he's doing. But he kind of annoys me a little bit.
It didn't take long.
Yeah, I think he could end up being a real pain in the arse, Solskjaer. Like, as a post-match figure, as a guy in interviews and press conferences.
Well, it is... interesting, yeah, that he
smiles. He's got a young looking face. You know, he's good head of hair. But I mean,
that he talks about
a bit of pain.
He said, "I've said all along, I'm going to be successful." But did you believe him when he said that yesterday?
Well, I would have believed him when he said it 3 weeks ago.
Well, see, this is why I'm referring to numbers as something to cling to in this raging torrent of emotion.
Yes,
one way or the other. It's either he's the greatest, you know, he's at the wheel, or and it's the wheel of time. It's the wheel. It's like it's a symbol of infinity.
Yeah, but you raise the numbers, and the numbers are supporting both those arguments. If you just go by results, because they have gone starkly one way and now starkly
and then starkly the other way. So the truth, as ever, is somewhere in between.
Oh yeah, that's what people want to hear on their bank holiday
podcast. But the fact that he has now started sort of challenging players, and this is obviously something that you don't. You know, it is like management 101, you know, like if possible, try to avoid public criticism of players. Now, it's not as though he named any individuals. I saw Gary Neville also saying, we don't need to name them. We don't need to name these individuals that we know. Everyone knows who they are. They're in the newspapers every day. They're on social media every single day. He'll deal with them. I mean, the mention of social media makes me assume that Paul Pogba is one of the players he's talking about, you know, just because to be honest, I didn't even follow Pogba. I'm not really hugely aware of what he's been doing on social media. Like maybe he does some Instagram stuff.
Pogba?
Yeah.
Oh, he does, isn't he? Is that not the whole thing?
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, I just assume social media is the code name for Pogba. You know, who else would he be talking about there?
True.
And does Anthony Martial do much?
Jesse Lingard.
Of Jesse Lingard.
Not necessarily. He doesn't get associated, but again, that's used as a positive. Like, you know,
Jesse Lingard was doing a feature for Sky with like Michael Keane. You know what I mean? He was part of the same program that Neville was working on. Like, I mean, he criticized him for that. Like, I don't know. I mean, okay. The point about this is that the fact that Solskjaer is now saying to the players, what this tells you is we're at a point now where there's a big sort out coming, is what I'm saying. They're about to have a proper sort out at Manchester United, and it's already underway. So when he's talking about these players, he's not talking about guys who he expects to still be working with. You know what I mean? I think they're gonna be going. I mean, I don't know if like Neville was talking about Japanese knotweed with the fury of a man who his personal struggle against Japanese knotweed.
That's an awful devil that gets into your garden, apparently.
Well, apparently.
Yeah.
He may have a sprawling garden.
I mean,
he did live for a while, anyway, in that Hobbit house. You know, there was that.
What?
Neville, like, his house was like tunneled out of a hillside or something like this. It was like eco house. So I don't know, maybe this knotweed is a big problem. He was angry about it. But, like, you know, we're getting close to the point at which, okay, what's going to happen here? Do you say, Anthony Martial, I love your talent, I love your ice cool finishing. I don't like the way that you sort of walk around in a lot of the games as though you don't really care what's going on here. Paul Pogba, you know, you've done some great things for us. At the same time, where have you been these last few weeks? You know, why can you not, you know, is it that you don't think we're a big enough club for you? Because if that is the case, then maybe it is time for you to go somewhere else. I mean, the thing that Solskjaer is talking about continually is distance and running. You know, like in terms of this is like the without which nothing, the basic thing that you need to have. And you know, if that's what you're looking for, then he's not really the player. You know, it may be time for them to look at getting rid of some of the big star players that they have and who they're maybe been enthralled to too much, and getting in some runners.
It is possible to get your existing players to run more, though, if you have the force of personality to do it. Like, just look at Pep Guardiola with Aguero and one or two others. Aguero is the one that springs to mind most obviously. Mm-hmm. Runs a good bit more than he used to because he realised, this is not a bad place for me to be at this point in my career, and to stay here, I actually have to get going a little bit here. I don't know if you can do that with Pogba. You should be able. There's no reason why you can't cover the ground. Maybe Martial is another one who you think could. No reason that he can't do another couple of kilometres. But supposedly that's what they were asked to do under Mourinho, not run a huge amount. And maybe it's just you get into a habit then of thinking that way.
Well, definitely the whole this is the difficult thing for him to sort out. It's like, is it the case that they're not doing it because they can't do it because they haven't been prepared to do it? And over the last couple of seasons, we've had a manager, and they were consistently the side that ran the least in the league or the second. You know what I mean? They were like way down, and that's what you get when you have a kind of quite passive game plan. You don't really want to go chasing the ball and so on and so forth. So it may be difficult to go overnight from one to the other, or you start getting injuries because the players aren't prepared for this, blah, blah, blah. Or is it the case that, you know, the flesh is not as weak as all that, but the spirit is not willing? Is that the problem? Mm. And that's a worse problem, because then it's like, well, what's, you know, what do I do here? I think there is definitely an issue where a lot of the players who they most want to hold on to look as though maybe they don't want to be there, and the ones who want to be there, they don't want. You know what I mean? There's that. That's they're in that unfortunate situation. So they need a sort of critical mass. They need to develop a critical mass of good players who actually are excited about their futures at Manchester United, that can kind of transmit itself to everybody else. So this suddenly feel, you know, you can. It's possible to turn the team around. I mean, you see what Jurgen Klopp did at Liverpool. You know, he took over from Brendan Rodgers. It was. The team had dissolved. There was nothing there. There was really very little there. Got them to the Europa League final in that season, which seemed very unlikely at the time. And now you see where they're at. And it's only been 3.5 years. You know, I mean, 3.5 years is actually quite a long time. But there's no reason why this couldn't happen.
Well, what about the reason that the rot has set in, as Richard Keys, Ken, has said today? He said, the problem with these hysterical calls for United to sell, 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 is who is going to buy. I watched this happen at Liverpool 30 years ago. Once the rot sets in, it's so hard to stop, and one mistake follows another.
Well, who's going to buy? Like, as in, how are they going to get rid of these players? I actually think that they've got quite a few saleable players. Maybe none of the prices they paid. I mean, Lukaku is clearly a player somebody would buy. Whether you get 75, you know, to 90 million for him is debatable. You know, there are a few players. I mean, Pogba is clearly saleable. De Gea is, you know, but again,
you it's be like, selling, yeah.
Want, you know, what are we doing here?
Let's just sell all
our. What kind of restructuring is this? Yeah, it has been a problem for them generally over the past few seasons. In fact, since Ronaldo left, so that's 10 years. They made very little money selling players. Mm. And partly that has to do with the position they occupy near the top of the food chain. You know, you're only selling the players who are, Ronaldo being an exception to this rule, but generally speaking, if you're selling a player, it's because you've decided you've already got the best out of that player. But more recently, it's been that the players haven't played well enough so that anyone wants to pay big fees for them. You know, it's a contrast with most of the, I mean, Tottenham, obviously, constantly have players, clubs trying to sign their players. You know, Liverpool selling Coutinho for that. I mean, the reason that they've been able to spend quite a lot of money on transfers is because getting huge amounts of money for a player like Coutinho, who they didn't really want to sell at the time, it appeared. But, you know, if you get like 140 million, yeah. You know, it's sort of, whereas with United, it hasn't been like that. You know, it's not, they would imagine they're a club that if they don't want to sell a player, they're not going to sell them anyway. But it's not as though players have done so well that clubs are like testing them a little bit. Oh, Real Madrid are interested in Martial. No, you know, nobody would be based on these types of performances.
He's a player, I think, that would get a lot of money, actually. I mean, well, he's super talented. He's young. It's not like he's been some sort of disaster. You know, he's had his moments. And I'm sure if you're a top manager, you're thinking, this guy, like, there's plenty to Anthony Martial's career. Yeah.
There's more to come.
Anyway.
But we will talk a bit more about them with Alan Swift, who's at their game. Because it is interesting with the two big games coming up this week against Man City and Chelsea. We should talk about City. City were playing again against Tottenham. against 12:30 on Saturday. And it was a strange game. Yeah. Similar to the other one in that there was a goal almost immediately. Phil Foden, the goal, and a good decision by Guardiola, I think, to play Phil Foden. That was when he got right, and he congratulated himself after. He said, oh, I am a genius now. I selected Phil Foden. After playing Delft in London, I'm a disaster, but now I'm a genius. He scored a goal. How good is the manager? You're like, settle down, Pep.
How does Pep have so much time to read all the criticism?
I know, it's amazing. He, maybe, I don't know.
He gets briefed.
He was chatting. The Arteta thing was going on again, but this time it seemed more relaxed. Like the Pep was kind of standing next to Arteta with his arms folded, just occasionally making a comment.
I would love to be able to somehow tunnel into Mikel Arteta's subconscious at night time and see what his dreams are like. So there's a lot of Pep in his dreams,
Oh, yeah.
Particularly his nightmares. Just roaring at him.
But there was Pep also nearly got nutmegged by Dele Alli. Dele Alli, who was like putting on a show.
Yeah, amazing. For about 8 minutes, he was absolutely amazing.
What happened? It was Dele Alli just put on this incredible exhibition of pointless skills. I mean, well, not I say pointless, but actually what he's doing is spinning away from opponents effortlessly into the space.
Yeah, drag kind of back heel nutmeg drag backs. Yeah. There's such a thing, all in one movement.
I have a friend who continually compares Dele Alli to David Platt, but I never saw David Platt do that kind of stuff.
No.
You know? I mean, I think he thinks that because he's a player who scores goals, including headers from midfield. But he also does that. But he did try to nutmeg Guardiola, who appeared to get pissed off. I don't know if you saw this. Guardiola, who, having successfully avoided the nutmeg from Dele Alli, the ball is going off the field, Ali's kind of chasing it, and then he just tries to throw in a nutmeg because it would have been funny, I suppose. Yeah. Guardiola didn't think it was funny. Then Guardiola, having given the ball to his player to take the throw in, starts standing there with his legs wide apart, indicating to, oh, yeah, you know, here's the target. Here's the target. And it's like, what's going on?
Well, Pep is a good player. He wouldn't usually be allow someone to nutmeg him without retribution.
He's a born competitor.
Yeah, born competitor. Ali, I just remembered, there's a passage in one of Michael Calvin's books. I think it was the one on managers living on the volcano. Ali was with MK Dons, wasn't he? Before mm-hmm. I've lost my mind entirely, yeah. So he must have been interviewing, Calvin must have gone to the MK Dons training ground to interview the MK Dons manager. And at some point, Dele Alli came over for a chat or was in the vicinity and apparently was doing keepy uppies with a piece of chewing gum. So like a finished piece of chewing gum, spat it out, a couple of knees in the air, a couple of kicks up in the air and then boots it away. Whatever about the golf ball or the tennis ball, you know, the real skillful players can keep them up. Keeping up a chewing gum for any more than one kick.
It's not bad.
Is an already chewed chewing gum. A bit disgusting, you know, hygiene-wise, not so sure about it, but he's a man who likes to show off now and again, show off his skills.
Why shouldn't he? I'm glad. I was glad to see it. In the end, City won the game, Foden with the goal. Maybe he's going to play against Man United because Kevin De Bruyne got injured. And, you know, maybe I'll have to also accept having spent the previous aftermaths of these games saying, why did you leave out Kevin De Bruyne for the biggest game? That maybe Kevin De Bruyne was close to an injury and here he's got an injury.
I did tentatively try to make that argument.
Yeah.
But I felt like you were getting too excited about De Bruyne's second leg.
Well, De Bruyne played against both Brighton in the Cup, which seems to me the more expendable game.
Yeah,
and true. Against, was it Palace? So, you know, I think the Tottenham game is bigger than those. But, you know, he's...
But I'd say he would have taken... I'd say Pep might have taken the three Spurs games as a block.
Yeah.
And thought, I can still get a result without him in the away leg. Then we'll finish it off at home. And I have him if I need him for the Premier League game.
Yeah.
But... Either way, it hasn't worked out at all because they've been knocked out of one competition and he's now lost to De Bruyne for probably a game or two in the Premier League.
Yeah, including because it really is coming down to this game now. Well, it looks that way at the moment against Manchester United, who have been hammered in the last two matches and really desperately need a result. I mean, it's obvious that where they... not to win, were they to lose the game, there would be a silver lining in the form of, well, you know, at least City have been given a push towards that, you know, keeping that Premier League title, which is kind of the default outcome of the season, and it wouldn't be as irritating as the alternative.
Yeah.
Although you do have to remember that for the actual Manchester United players who are taking part in this, they all have clauses enforcing massive pay cuts if they don't get into the Champions League. Like a quarter of their money disappears. So
I did see that Sanchez is on whatever he's on contract-wise, including bonuses. I had to think, whatever bonuses Sanchez is supposed to be hitting, I would imagine, yeah, certainly as an individual, he hasn't been hitting that many, and a few team bonuses might go out the window as well.
Yeah. There's big pay cuts for the players, although some of the players maybe are like, well, it doesn't matter because I'm not going to be here for that. We will see. But, you know, City, Bernardo gave Foden his Man of the Match award, which was a nice touch. I think it's good for City to bring in a player like Foden, actually, at this point, just to sort of remind them, after a low point of the season, what they've got in reserve. You know what I mean? Like, this guy is actually really potentially top player.
Well, Neville made the point in commentary, Gary Neville, that he has been speaking to a couple of the youth coaches at City, and the feeling is they may as well pack it in if they can't get Foden into the first team regularly. Like, this guy's incredible. Even there's a load of brilliant young English players. They feel he's the best of them all, so he should be playing for Manchester City.
Yeah. Well, I think he probably will be, because, you know, we've seen at this point the way that City are evolving. I mean, De Bruyne has had this injury season. Silva, David Silva, is
okay.
David Silva is yesterday's man. Bernardo Silva has arguably been the best player of the season, but has started to play on the wing more. I mean, I don't mean started to play on the wing. He always has played in that position as well as in midfield, but he's being used more there. So that does create a space in midfield now, which was hard to see how Foden gets in ahead of those players if they're all fit. But if De Bruyne is not fit and Silva's gone and Bernardo's not in that area, then why not? Mm-hmm. Spurs, incidentally, you know, when you saw the Spurs team, you thought, oof, you know, we see where Spurs' priorities were. Although I have to say that one Foyt in the game looked far, far better than Kieran Trippier as a defender. I know that Trippier would not be in the team for defensive ability alone, let's say, if it wasn't for the fact that he takes good set pieces and has good delivery from the right and so on. This is his main weapon as a player. But Foyt just was far more assured looking defensively, up against Sterling and then Sané. You know, I think he might kind of play his way into the team.
I must say, I worried for the lad early on. He just Foyt got turned inside out at one stage by Sterling. Nothing spectacular. It's standard when you're up against Raheem Sterling. He's going to get past you at a point or two. And I did feel, oh, this could be tricky. But yeah, he stuck to it and did really well.
Yeah. Sterling, incidentally, had a bit of a meltdown towards the end of the game where he could have been sent off. And it was interesting to see this. Sterling now has the England halo effect, you know? He's got to do a lot more to get sent off than anybody else. I mean, he did get booked for having the last of a series of kind of rows with Spurs players. The one that he got booked for was Vertonghen, I think. But he'd already kind of picked a fight with pretty much every member of the Spurs defense.
The goalkeeper at one stage.
Yes. And but I thought that he should have been booked before that for his delaying of a free kick. You know, Spurs are trying to take a free kick. They're sort of in the 88th or 89th minute, because City just went into full-on kill-the-game mode and managed to do so pretty successfully for the last 10 or 15 minutes, because they had looked a bit ropey. And, you know, the pressure's on, only one goal lead. Sterling, like, disgraceful time-wasting. I mean, he's doing exactly what he's supposed to do, you know. But it kind of amazes me that a referee, you know, if the player had kicked the ball away, he's obviously going to book him. But these types of fouls, or this type of foul play, which is in effect the same thing, just doesn't get picked up. It's like been a huge thing of Guardiola's teams, actually, and certainly of the Man City team, that, like, you know, if you kick them or foul them, Pep will complain about that, and he'll be like, you know, what's going on? But as soon as they lose the ball to you, they're kicking you in the back. Like, you know, they're going to put you down. So yeah, that was City.
It was interesting watching the Sky Sports trying their best to will this to be as good as the Champions League game. And in fairness, in the early stages, it looked like it might be, but they kept talking about how City are going to need more goals. They're going to need more goals here because Spurs are going to score some goals.
Yeah.
And eventually got to the final whistle and it was all a little bit, you know, 1-0. Martin Tyler says something like, I know it might, if you just tuned in late and see the score, it might feel a little after the Lord Mayor's ball, but this has been a seriously tense game to rival what we saw. No, it has. It has been tense, yes.
Oh, it was tense.
A perfectly fine game in its own right.
But yeah, Son, you know, had one of those days. He looked like he couldn't miss, you know, in the Champions League game. And then he actually had more chances, I think, in the in the league game and just wasn't quite on the same level of sharpness.
Liverpool have kept the pressure up.
Yeah, and Klopp complaining about the pitch. He does like to make a note on the conditions, Jurgen Klopp, whether the wind or the dryness of the grass. But you could actually see this after a few minutes of game. It's like that. It looks like they put syrup on the grass. You know, it's like the ball was rolling as though the pitch is waterlogged or has snow on it. You know, that kind of where it rolls and suddenly starts to it slows down. And the pitch was, you said it was very sticky pitch, which they hadn't bothered to water. Turned out Liverpool had anticipated this and trained on this pitch, even though Klopp doesn't like doing it because he says the dry pitch is dangerous. That's the reason we don't like playing on them. In the end, the dry pitch actually helped Liverpool, or in the penalty that Salah won for the second goal, you can see the ball is challenged. Firmino challenges for the ball. It flies up in the air, spinning backwards really fast, and Salah watches it and delays his run because he knows that ball is coming, is bouncing straight back in this direction. You know, it's not, usually it would keep going more or less the direction, but he stopped and waited for it to bounce back to him, then headed it on, at which point he ran into the box and executed a 9.9 dive. According to Neil Warnock, amazing. Warnock is unbelievable. I mean, you could see Warnock standing next to the fourth official a bit like Pep and Arteta. Like, he's just been standing there the whole game, just giving him his opinion on events. But like you're like, I'd love to hear what Warnock is saying to him there, because he's just got this big sarcastic face on him. Like, once again, he's the victim of this monstrous injustice. But you're looking at the thing. I don't understand how it couldn't have been a penalty.
Yeah,
it's like he's doing a Heimlich maneuver on Salah. Or like, how? Since when is that not a penalty?
You've got to, if you're the defender there, you've got to disengage, as they might say in rugby, at some point. He would disengage for a very split second and then just re-engage, get the bear hug going again. And it just went on for so long that it was almost comical. Although Salah did then, at the end of it, make the most out of it. But sometimes defenders get away with that stuff if you don't go to ground. Unfortunately, it's a dirty word in football. Diving, simulation, call it what you will. And Salah is happy enough. He's a pretty regular practitioner of it. Yeah. But when you have been felled, like, the point was it's a penalty.
Yeah.
And you could make the argument then, a separate argument nearly, that Salah's making a meal of it. But the actual decision to award the penalty against a weaker team, it always seems to happen to them and so on. Mm. But in this case, it was the correct decision.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it is one of those things that the VAR will sort out. I was listening to, actually, there was a podcast recently I heard.
Well, the VAR may not sort out, as we've discussed many times.
Well, I was listening to this podcast by, you know, Michael Lewis, the Moneyball writer and, you know, journalist. He has a series called, I think, Against the Rules. And I just listened to this one of them, which was about refereeing in the NBA. And he goes to, like, the referee center, whatever, you know, like the VAR bunker kind of thing. And is, like, kind of talking about these changes and how they've affected basketball. And, you know, the changes that have been seen are effectively home advantage is being whittled away to nothing, because home advantage really consists in the referee giving the home team favorable calls, influenced by the crowd and atmosphere and everything, because, you know, the referee's a human being and it's entirely natural to be influenced by your surroundings in this way. That's one big effect. So it's been good for smaller teams, and it's been bad for star players. He makes this interesting point that he's not that big of a basketball fan, really, but whenever he could see players who were shouting up in a referee's face and shouting at the referee, he always seemed to recognize that player. And it turned out that the reason for this was that it was the famous players who would do it, like Sterling against Tottenham. Like, if you are a big star player, you feel entitled to abuse the referee in a way that some nobody doesn't. You know what I mean? So
not only entitled, but you feel like it might work.
Oh, it will. It will work. Sorry, it's not you feel like it might. You know it will work. Like that England halo effect, where the best players in the England national team could not be sent off in the Premier League is a fact. Like, it's a reality. So that's a change. The VAR essentially this thing seem to make out if it follows what's happened in the NBA. And it is interesting to hear about what's happened there, like in terms of just the level of analysis of everything that a referee does now. Like the statistics that they have on what referees do, you know, they can kind of run any kind of analysis. Like, are you more likely to award a foul in X situation, Y situation, you know, if the player, it's like, it is kind of scary. Like the referees don't know this stuff about themselves. You know, it's like more, there is more data on them than they can possibly be aware of about their own lives.
Is it a good podcast? I'm looking for recommendations.
Well, I've only listened to that one, but I found it interesting enough.
It's Michael Lewis, sounds good.
Just the last thing here before we talk to Alan Smith is, it looks as though Thierry Henry is going to be back in a job. Thierry Henry is touted as the new manager of the New York Red Bulls, who are obviously his Major League Soccer team that he represented for, I think, 4 seasons. So fair play to him on getting back in after Monaco. I mean, I saw there was an interview recently with Golovin, the Russian player. Remember Russia's World Cup hero?
Yes.
Alexander Golovin, who joined Monaco in the summer. And obviously Thierry Henry took over there. I think a couple of weeks ago, I was like, yeah, you know, Thierry Henry, maybe, you know, he kind of still thought he was a player, you know. When things weren't working out during practice, he would get nervous and yell a lot. Maybe it was a bit unnecessary. He would try to go out in the field and show us how to practice and yell. Maybe a different manager would say, come on, guys, let's go. Get it together. But he would get nervous right away and run onto the field and start playing and showing us things. He would scream, try to get the ball away from me. Players were mostly calm, but maybe they were in a bit of shock. You could tell he didn't fully transition into the role of manager. He was a very strong player, and the only players near his level at Monaco are maybe Falcao and Fabregas. So,
and Fabregas, isn't, at his age, is not a man who's going to be chasing Thierry Henry around the pitch trying to get the ball back.
No, it sounds like Fabregas is probably, at this point, the more chilled out and mature character. Imagine Henry running around, trying to get the ball away from me. Well, okay, Thierry, you've always been a wonderful player, and congratulations on what looks like it could be a quick return to management.
So, Fiat asked that question. Pretty strange. Yeah, very disappointed, yeah, but there you go.
What have I become? My sweetest friend.
I mean, at the time I thought that you were completely in the right.
Everyone I know.
But now I think.
Goes away.
Should have just played in, just played in.
I'm surprised you're really asking that question.
And you could have it all.
No, well, it doesn't matter really what you think.
My empire of dirt.
Yeah, you weren't there at the time.
I will let you down.
You weren't an international player.
I will make you hurt.
And you hadn't had the frustrations I had.
If I could start again.
You've not played at the international level. And you hadn't been accused of faking an injury, so
I will keep myself.
What you think doesn't really matter.
I would find a way.
All right, Alan Smith was at Goodison yesterday for the Times, the London Times, that is, to witness, well, what looked like a bit of a filleting of this rather flaky Manchester United team. Alan, was it as bad as it looked?
Yeah, I think, you know, the performance of some players was actually quite disgraceful. even at 1-0, there was a moment, I'm not sure if it was caught on TV, but Fred basically had the ball midfield, two options. He had Martial on his left, had Pogba kind of on the right, sort of in the centre circle. He chose to give the ball to Martial, move broke down, and Pogba just threw this almighty hissy fit. And this is at 1-0, which sort of, you know, seems to sort of encapsulate the sort of the body language and the level of application from some of the players, and it just, you know, it just got worse from there. I don't think any one of the United players kind of, you know, acquitted themselves well. And Solskjaer sort of made reference afterwards that he's, you know, he's going to be successful in the future, and a lot of these players won't be part of that team. So, you know, I actually feel that come the Manchester Derby on Wednesday night and Chelsea the weekend, a lot of this squad are now playing for their futures at the club.
Yeah, there was a lot of pointed stuff from Solskjaer after the game. And whatever about whether he has to look at himself in the mirror, just the question of how the players have lost form so spectacularly. I don't get it. You know, they had that defeat against PSG, which was pretty bad in the first leg, but they came back from that to win. That was March 6th. Since then, though, 6 defeats in 8 games, and the wins, one of them anyway, Solskjaer admitted was a little bit lucky. Others said the other win was probably a bit lucky as well. So they've really fallen apart spectacularly. I know there's this new manager bounce that can wear off, but rarely have I seen the bounce go so high and the fall go so low.
Yeah, I mean, Solskjaer sort of made the point over in the past couple of weeks that the players just aren't fit enough, which, you know, it seems to be sort of a dig at Mourinho, yeah, in terms of the fact that, you know, they're unable to kind of sustain this, you know, the game plan that he wants, which, you know, is more kind of, you know, high intensity pressing, etc. But it was fascinating to kind of hear his reaction at full time yesterday afternoon when it was pointed out to him that Everton had run eight kilometres farther than United yesterday, and he just sort of went into this sort of Fabian Delph like monologue about, you know, the basics of football and the need to sort of apply yourself. You have to run; that's the minimum. There was the sort of, you know, the gratuitous reference to playing under Sir Alex and how the fact that we always ran more than everyone else, which, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's obviously quite true, but it's about sort of the players. I think, you know, it almost seems cliched, and it's sort of, from Solskjaer's point of view, it sort of, you know, it goes down well with the supporters, but he's sort of continuously, during this bad run, made the point that these players need to show that they care and they appreciate what it means to play for Manchester United, what it means to wear the shirt, etc. And I think yesterday, a lot of them just showed that they don't appreciate the meaning that Solskjaer likes to put forward.
There does seem to be a real movement against those players now, doesn't there, Al? I mean, you know, it might be because only a few weeks ago, you know, all the pundits were saying, let's build a statue of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I mean, one of the, you know, Gary Neville had an epic rant about the players and what a disgrace they were. And he literally was saying to Solskjaer, you know, after the PSG game, where do you want the statue? So it's a case that nobody can now really criticize what Solskjaer's been doing for fear of seeming incredibly foolish. I mean, he's literally been in the job permanently less than a month, yeah, and is supervising a run of form that would normally get you sacked, which can't now happen because of the extraordinary circumstances here, meaning that it's really the players who find themselves in the firing line now, and it's hard to see what the escape is unless the escape route leads directly out of the club.
Yeah, and I think as well, it's because of sort of, you know, because of Mourinho and Van Gaal, where the players had these excuses that in Van Gaal's case, they were sort of handcuffed by these rigid tactics and the style of play didn't suit them, etc. And then Mourinho was, you know, it was, you know, he doesn't give us enough freedom. And the players had, initially, when Solskjaer had come in as caretaker, made a big deal about stressing about, you know, we're allowed to enjoy our football again, and that's why we're playing this way. And, you know, those excuses have been used up now. They don't have any left. In terms of Solskjaer himself, I mean, I don't think he's, you know, entirely blameless. There have been a lot of, you know, tactical tweaks during recent games, which don't really seem to have had any effect. I'm not really sure he's convinced what his best starting 11 is. And I mean, like, even if you look at sort of Solskjaer's sort of brief managerial history before turning up at United, Cardiff, you know, bit of a disaster there. How much can you sort of judge his success at Mold when it's, you know, it's a league kind of near sort of the bottom of the ladder in terms of European rankings? So, you know, Solskjaer's a coach. I think, you know, there are some questions to be answered, not necessarily now. I think in the future, when he's had a transfer window, and as he keeps pointing out, he's had a pre-season to get the players up to the fitness he likes. In terms of the support, obviously he's got pretty, you know, unanimous backing, and much of it, of course, is down to his history as a player at the club. But, you know, there will reach a point in the future, perhaps next season, when, you know, things will turn against him. But for now, it's all about the players' lack of application, their, you know, their failure to carry out the as he kept saying yesterday, the basics of football.
Yeah, it is an unusual situation to be in. I mean, especially when you look at the way that he spoke in his first few weeks in the job, and obviously they were winning the whole time, so it's obviously a lot easier to sit there after you've won than after you've lost 4-0 at Everton. And, you know, he would say things like, you know, football when you've got good players, football is easy. And these are obviously the same players that, I mean, you mentioned his sort of Delph talk. He, you know, he was saying stuff like, it's about sticking your head in where it hurts. It's about putting your body on the line. It hurts to win football games and all this kind of stuff. If that's going to be his basic ethos, and you know, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, I basically agree with Ole here that you need to work hard, and like, I mean, he seemed to be kind of talking a bit about the first goal, Richarlison's goal, which even Graeme Souness I saw saying he thought it was dangerous play, but Ole obviously reckoned that the defender should have stuck the head in there. But you know, if this is going to be the ethos, then when you look at the squad that is there, I mean, because this is, we're almost at the time now when decisions have to be made about who stays and who goes. He said yesterday, we can't just replace the whole squad in like one summer. Some players are going to be here, some players are not going to be here. But which players do you feel fall into which category? I mean, if we talk about the big players in this team.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky, isn't it? Because if you look at, say, Alexis Sanchez seems to be the big one in terms of, you know, he's clearly not really wanted by Solskjaer. A lot of the fans have sort of, you know, given up hope in him coming good at United. But at the same time, because he's been paid so much, you know, is any club going to come in and genuinely offer, you know, submit a bid to sign a player who's, you know, going to command $300,000 a week?
I kind of almost feel with him, though, he's kind of been left out so much at this stage that he's almost in one of the players in comparative credit because he hasn't been out disgracing himself week after week. I mean, he's already done that. Like, I mean, there's players like Pogba, Martial and De Gea, who I think everybody would rate as among the best players in that squad, who haven't really performed. I mean, I know that Pogba is such a kind of controversial player even to discuss because people say, oh, it's unfair. You know, people are always criticizing him and actually he was one of the better players yesterday. But, you know, Martial, this dive that he did was like his one memorable thing. De Gea. You know, like, I mean, I think it's 5 goals he's let in from outside the box this year in the Premier League. 8, if you count the 3 he let in at Barcelona from outside the box. I mean, that's not him.
Yeah. I mean, I think De Gea would be justified if he was going to have a go at the defenders in front of him because they have been awful for quite a while now. And I mean, that second goal yesterday, you know, you could make an argument that he should get across to save it. But at the same time, Sigurdsson should not be allowed to have a shot from that distance with Matic sort of jogging by his side and sort of, as Solskjaer said, not putting his body on the line.
I wonder which comes first there, though. And I do wonder which comes first when it's a goalkeeper and a defence playing like that. Is it that the goalkeeper is... who has been absolutely outstanding for him. He's been their best player, like comfortably for a number of years. But he clearly is having a poor season by his standards with a couple of great games thrown in like the one against Spurs. But he's made more mistakes than he's ever made in a season. And I wonder, does that transmit itself to the defence and they start getting jittery and then it feeds back?
Yeah, I think it definitely goes both ways. And I mean, there was that moment yesterday, I think it was at 3-0 when Sigurdsson had this corner from the left and it sort of almost bent in at the near post.
Yeah.
You know, De Gea got across and, you know, I'm sure it looked like a pretty good save and he kind of stuck his right boot out and cleared it. But initially, if you look at it, he's actually distracted by a bunch of players sort of on the edge of the 6-yard box rather than watching the ball. And that just, you know, that just screams a lack of focus and a lack of attention, which, you know, is very De Gea like. But then again, if you go back to like the World Cup last summer, was he, you know, didn't seem in particularly special form. So I think this has been there a while. So yeah, he is quite interesting. Ken mentioned Pogba. And I think, you know, again, like it seems like you're kind of going around in circles all season by saying, you know, Pogba, you know, he's always going to let you down, etc. But it is just incredibly frustrating because you can see in certain games that this is a player with, you know, this incredible amount of talent, but he's quite happy so often to just waltz through. And I mean, even like the point I made earlier about him throwing this hissy fit at 1-0, it's just the body language is just so disappointing when you kind of, you know, in that situation as this sort of, you know, the player who's maybe the heart of the midfield, the one who's supposed to take control, he just goes the opposite direction, and you know that kind of his head slumps. He, you know, just doesn't really seem that bothered, and he's having a go at his teammates for not passing the ball to him. It wasn't like in that situation Fred had sort of given the ball away. He'd just chosen to give it to another United player, and that sort of body language, I think, is, you know, just very, if you're a United supporter, must be very, very disappointing.
Yeah, and just to be clear on De Gea, like, I'm not putting him into that category that I think they should sell him by any means. I would actually just be, they have to get him back into form next season, and I'd be concerned if I was involved at Manchester United that De Gea's probably looking around and thinking, well, we'll have to see how the transfers go during the summer, but I'd say he's sick of being the best player. he probably wants to be about the third. He wants to be the best paid player, sure. And then maybe he'd like to be about the third or fourth best player actually on the pitch. Just let others take up the slack. There could be just a loss of focus with the idea that for a long time now, he's been playing at a club that he's actually, they haven't been at his level. And that might continue to be the case. Ken, sorry, you wanted to come in there.
No, I totally agree with that. And I get that sense of Pogba as well, that he's like a little bit embarrassed to be playing for this team now, you know, like that he feels he should be playing for a better team. And I mean, I've seen players in his position who are maybe the most talented. I mean, you're saying De Gea is the best and he probably has been the most effective player, but like, you know, clearly better than players. I mean, the example, because Pogba's like him in a couple of other ways, I think, as well as Steven Gerrard for years at Liverpool was playing with terrible, like, I mean, compared to him, just not really the teammates who weren't at his level, but you never got this sense of kind of, oh, I don't know. I mean, he did try to join Chelsea a couple of times, but on the field, it wasn't really obvious. But I wonder, Alan, if you think, I mean, you know, clearly there's a lot of, as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is now saying, there's no quick fix. This is a major rebuild. And, you know, Ed Woodward is under some pressure to put the club's resources to work. But another feature of this discussion around Manchester United for the last few years has been the fact that their spending has been so unstructured because there isn't really anybody who knows the game who's in charge of the kind of big picture plan. I mean, they have been speaking about maybe bringing in a director of football for a long time. You know, Jose Mourinho didn't want to work with one, but now it seems like that might be something they're looking at. Still no appointment. But obviously it would have to be somebody who works with Solskjaer. Or who could work with Solskjaer. What do you think is the likelihood of somebody who's already working with him, Mike Phelan, being offered that job?
I saw those stories this morning. I mean, it'll be quite interesting. And I think one of the big issues with Solskjaer is that while he obviously understands the club and, you know, the big thing that he's always stressing is that, you know, he's sort of in touch with the supporters and he gets it, which is a phrase that they like to use quite a lot. I think one of his issues could be his actual coaching ability on the training ground. And it strikes me that, you know, that's Phelan's strength, really, isn't it? I know the stories that have been around have kind of suggested that if Phelan moves up to that director of football role, Carrick would become the assistant manager. And, you know, we've kind of seen, heard little bits about, you know, some players being impressed by how well Carrick has taken to coaching. But I think, you know, undoubtedly United need somebody to come in to oversee transfers, because even looking at the team yesterday, when you consider the amount of money they've spent, the centre back partnership was still Smalling and Jones, who've both signed new contracts this season. And if you think about that game 5 years ago when it was that PR stunt where the Grim Reaper was behind David Moyes and at Goodison Park, which ended up being his last game. It was 5 years ago. 5 years ago to the day yesterday. Smalling and Jones were the centre backs there. So with all the money you've spent since then, for the heart of the defence not really to be, you know, upgraded as such. I know other players have come through and haven't really been good enough, but, you know, when that's quite clearly an issue, that, I mean, ultimately, I think come the summer, that is the one area where, despite Smalling and Jones signing new deals, they have to strengthen there. And it really, it needs someone, they need someone to come in, take the sort of footballing matters away from Woodward, because obviously, I mean, people have said at length for a couple of years now that he is quite a good negotiator in terms of commercial opportunities, etc. And because of that, the Glazers actually, you know, think he's doing a really good job. But in terms of the football, someone has to come in, oversee the transfer policy, because otherwise, you know, there's no way United are going to get anywhere closer to City or Liverpool, or even maybe Spurs come next season.
What about the short term, Al, having seen them at the weekend? Some of the players disgrace themselves, as you say. Are you giving them any chance of rousing themselves for this big midweek fixture? Can they possibly deliver a league title to Liverpool with a win against, or even a draw against Man City?
I think ultimately it depends on how much personal pride matters to them, doesn't it? Because, you know, if those players, you know, will have heard about Solskjaer's reaction, will have seen him in the dressing room afterwards, will have noted that the fans, I mean, the fans yesterday, there was a moment, I think it was about 15 minutes ago, when United finally strung together about four passes and the away end just started chanting Ole. I mean, that is humiliating. And I think if you're a player, and if you have any personal pride, come Wednesday night, you need to go out and deliver a performance. I think if City turn up, I can't see United getting a result. I think it will be, you know, if United are to end up winning or possibly even getting a draw from that game on Wednesday night, it'll be very much down to City not playing at their best. And, you know, beyond that, then United also have to play Chelsea next weekend. So, and because of the Arsenal result yesterday, Crystal Palace winning, top four is still actually, you know, within reach, but that performance just suggests to me that not enough players are, you know, care enough for them to actually finish there.
Okay, which is a pretty damning indictment. Alan, brilliant stuff. Thanks so much.
Cheers.
31 years old. I want to play more. I think there is more in me. Certainly there's big opportunity with Dr. Crokes, and there's huge opportunity with Kerry. And I still want to be part of that, and I feel I can make a contribution towards that. So why stop something that you love so much?
Great opportunity here. You've joined us by our cue from the 6 o'clock news for a Kerry goal. And it's Colin Cooper who's put it in. Sometimes we just get lucky when you join us on the 6 o'clock news live with our audience here on Network 2 as well.
Selling dummies left, right and centre. Inside again to Dan Sullivan. It must be a goal, Johnny!
Goal by the coach! Goal by the coach! Dan O'Sullivan went through the counterfeit like a scalded cat. Gave it to the coach and the coach rolled the ball into the back of the net.
It must be a goal, Johnny!
Consistency. That's what we often hear. We want consistency from referees. Probably also want consistency from the team you support, assuming that the results are reasonably positive. And you'd have to say that, given where Newcastle are at in terms of their net spend and the fact that Benitez seems to be at war at all times with the club owner, Newcastle's consistency of the last two seasons is unbelievable. I don't know if you've seen this weird quirk of the league table, which has been, this has been going on for a while. I watched it a few weeks ago. I watched Newcastle and they had the exact same record as they had last year, and they've kept it up, or they've come back around again. So 35 games gone. Last year they had won 11, drawn 8, lost 16. This year they've won 11, drawn 8, lost 16. That's coincidental enough, but when you get into the goal difference, goals scored 35 last year, goals scored 35 this year, and conceded 44 last year, conceded 44 this year, points 41. It's pretty remarkable, crazy, isn't it? Yeah. I don't know how they've managed that, but even more impressive this year, if anything, because when they got back to the Premier League, it was all Benitez trying to put pressure on to get money, to get transfers. Didn't really work, hasn't worked this season. I'm always assuming that at some stage it's just going to blow up for them, but I don't know if you would put it all down to Benitez himself, how good a manager he is, that he gets them to stay reasonably comfortably in the Premier League. Or is it being overstated? Like, they're a big club, should they not expect to be staying up? It's only 41 points after all, 35 games. Not exactly amazing.
Yeah, and no, I don't. I mean, you can say they're a big club, but they don't have a big budget. You know, they're not like they're bigger than they they seem bigger than they are.
It's like very similar to Sunderland in the documentary, the Netflix documentary. Oh, we're a big club. Chris Coleman comes in. It's great to manage such a big club. And you're thinking, it's not that great, Chris, because the fans expect big things and you don't have any money. In fact, in some ways, it's the worst type of club to manage.
Yeah, you are, you can't really live up to the expectations. I mean, the question with Newcastle are safe now. I think the Cardiff losing to Liverpool meant that they couldn't catch Newcastle. So they will be in the Premier League next year. But the question is whether Benitez will stay. Because, sure, he could probably keep them up again. But maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe it would start to come apart. I mean, like, that kind of consistency is remarkable. He's able to get these players to really focus. And it's not like playing for Benitez's team is always like a huge amount of fun, I don't think. You know, it's like, it's pretty hard work, and he does like to pull people up on the little things they're doing wrong and try to get them focusing on, you know, what they're doing. But, you know, these things can only last for a certain amount of time before it starts to, players start to get annoyed or bored with this, or, you know, these things happen. So in the absence of like fresh impetus from, Ashley signing players, bringing in new players, giving them the sense that...
Or Ashley finally selling the club and somebody else coming along.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's... I've been talking about that for ages. I mean, in the absence of like something new, like the same thing, even the fans will start to be like, oh, you know, we're tired of this, you know, like irrationally and ungratefully, but like that's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. You can't just keep doing the same thing because everybody gets bored of it. So the question is whether he'll stay, because there's plenty of clubs that could, you know, offer him, I imagine, a better setup than he's got. The one thing that he does have, and I think it's something that he understands quite well, Benitez, given the sort of career he's had, is the kind of the love of la gente, the people of Newcastle. And that is a big deal for a manager, especially Rafa, who had this at Liverpool, where again he was at war with the board, and the crowd would sort of always support him and take his side in these disagreements. But when he went to Inter, he was straight out of there. And when he went to Real Madrid, these are like the big glamour jobs. Again, he was straight out of there. Like at Madrid, the crowd just were like, why do we have this guy as our manager? This guy should not be Real Madrid manager. Players were the same. Board eventually was the same. There was no support for him. So I think he understands the value of that. And it's not something I think he would give up on lightly. Like if Newcastle were to say, here's some money. Here's like, you know, like some kind of transfer budget. Mm. Like, they're not going to be like Man City or even Everton, you know. They're not going to do that. But if they were to sort of say, here's enough to maybe make progress with, I think he would stay, because it's like, this is what, you know, he's already managed Real Madrid. You know what I mean? It's not going to happen again. This job is worth persevering with, but it has to be under conditions where he's not risking just making a fool of himself.
Football podcast this Thursday will feature the Manchester Derby. See if Man United can find it within them to topple Manchester City, or at least cause them some problems. So we'll have that one for you on the World Service. It's a rugby podcast tomorrow. In the meantime, Ken, we should probably go out and enjoy some of this bank holiday sunshine. Thanks for today.
Thank you very much, Owen.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.